My name is Bojan Karabalev. I'm the policy lead at the Workers' Observatory. You're listening to Gig Workers' Guide to the Scottish Election. Gig work is becoming more common in Scotland, yet issues of low pay and unsafe working environment get little attention from policymakers. Ahead of the Holyrood election on the 7th of May 2026, delivery riders from Edinburgh Collective Room launched 5 policies to transform gig work in Scotland. In this series, we explore how these policies might be widely applied, focusing on the perspectives of migrant workers who constitute the majority of this growing workforce. We bring together delivery riders, people from academia, and grassroots organizers to discuss the best way to implement these demands, whilst offering a reality check from those who work on the front line. Today, we focus on policy number 5, a proper picture of gig work in Scotland. We're joined by Karen and Sam. Hello, both.
Hello.
Hello.
Karen, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure, Bojan. My name is Karen Gregory. I'm a sociologist at the University of Edinburgh, and I'm an affiliated researcher with the Workers' Observatory.
Thank you. And Sam, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, I'm Sam. I'm a food delivery courier in Edinburgh.
Thank you both for being here. So gig work and gig economy are terms we use a lot on this podcast, and also in general, they come up a lot when talking about this kind of stuff, as well as the related term platform work. But people can sometimes mean different things when using these terms. So Karen, can you tell us a bit more about what gig work means?
Yeah, absolutely. I think when people hear the term gig economy, they actually think of a couple specific things, maybe an on-demand delivery rider on the street, you know, someone on a bike with a big bag behind them, or maybe like you're thinking about Uber and waiting, you know, push a button and waiting for your car to arrive. But actually, those two platforms are really just the tip of the iceberg. And I think in Scotland, we really need to think much more broadly about things like not just ride hailing and food delivery, but, you know, the wide range of platforms for hosting in your home, Airbnb platforms that are shaping cities, and all of the workers that hide behind those platforms. I can talk a bit more about that later. But also things like freelancers working for creative platforms, people who are doing, you know, home repair or cleaning through apps, and the wide economy now of care work that is being platformed. You know, and I think if we even wanted to maybe take a very wide perspective on what the gig economy is or the platform economy is, we'd also have to look at people who are using platforms like Etsy and eBay or other online markets and social media to make a living. So I think rather than thinking about the gig economy or gig work as one type of job, it'd probably be better for us to really think about gig work as a kind of platform-mediated labor market, where apps really sit in the middle of all of that, connecting customers, connecting workers and services. And just a footnote there is that platforms often do say, we're just a platform, we are not employers. So there's a real caveat here about the kind of work that can happen through a platform. And I also think, importantly, this is the kind of work that sits in among other types of jobs. It's not one thing. You're not just a delivery rider, maybe. You might also be working at the Aldi or the Lidl, or trying to cobble together lots of different types of work with this. So it's really something that sits in everyday life and people pick up and they put down when they don't need it.
Yeah, I think that's very interesting that it's actually a much wider part of the economy than people think. And we're seeing it grow even more, right?
Well, yeah, I mean, platforms have now been around for 10 plus years. So that's a bit of time to watch this workforce grow. But actually, there's research in the UK that suggests that since 2016, the gig economy has actually quite significantly grown in the UK, possibly even doubled, with up to 1 in 10 working age adults now working in some kind of gig work weekly. But again, as I was alluding to earlier, there's a bit of a problem here because there's really no standard definition of what a gig worker is in official statistics. So gig workers often are hidden in other categories like self-employed workers, temporary workers, people on flexible contracts. And actually, I think it makes that variation makes it quite hard to get to grips with precisely how many people are working in these sectors at any given time. It's something that I think as researchers, we now need to really work cooperatively and collaboratively on to get a really good picture of what's going on day to day.
Yeah, for sure. So when we talk about a proper picture of gig work in Scotland, can you elaborate a bit more on what's missing?
Yeah, I mean, as I just suggested, I think what's missing is coherence. There's no particular definition of what a gig worker is or agreed upon definition of what a gig worker is. So we do have data. The UK collects a lot of data about work and workers and labor forces, but the data that we have is really fragmented. We're only now starting to see some longitudinal work come out, and many research projects, including the ones that I've run, often take a snapshot of gig workers' lives. We interview you now, we look at what's happening in your life, how you're negotiating risks, but we need to now start looking over time. And I think going through existing data actually would be really wonderful. The other thing I want to stress here is that we're not really talking about just one gig economy. There are really multiple gig economies in Scotland. We're looking at regional differences, urban versus rural differences, and all of that needs to be gotten to grips with as we look through the available data in order to get a really nice picture of what's happening in the country.
So when you're talking about these regional differences, I'm guessing some of that will be like the divide between like rural and urban areas.
Absolutely.
Like, can you give us some examples? Because most of what we talk about here is like urban gig work, like a lot of our focus has been on delivery riders in Edinburgh.
Yeah.
But can you tell us a bit more about the other kinds of gig work in terms of regional differences?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I know that the Workers Observatory is based in Edinburgh, so it makes sense that you have a focus on this city. And if you look at cities like Edinburgh and Glasgow, you're probably going to find that, you know, the gig economy looks like food delivery, it looks like ride hailing, it looks like on-demand services. But if you move your view out a bit to rural spaces like the Highlands and Islands, platform work is going to look a lot more like short-term rentals and Airbnb use, and also tourism-related services. In places like the Isle of Skye, for example, a significant proportion of housing has gone up in short-term lets. So platforms are shaping those local economies in very different ways than they're shaping them in cities.
Yeah, for sure. And not all gig work is visible in the same way, is it?
Absolutely. So you walk down the street, you might see Sam as a rider, or you can really see an Uber driver. But actually, it's a lot harder to get to grips with actually how many flats are being rented or how many homes are being rented. And I think there's a difference here to get, again, as we think about getting a clear picture. So I think there's something called really what we could look at as visible gig work, delivery riders, private hire cars. And these are some of the most visible people in cities. They're often doing this work full time. And they tend to face higher risks, which I think is interesting. They're doing physically demanding work. There's exposure to weather, as Sam will probably talk about. There's road danger. But there's also this whole world of hidden gig work. And I think this is actually a much larger world. And then we talk about data, it's really getting to grips with some of the things that are harder to see here. Freelance digital work, people working from home on all kinds of creative platforms, cleaning and domestic services, which obviously will make cater more to migrant workers and to female workers. So it might be even harder to find those people. And lots of admin, IT, and design work that's happening through platforms. In fact, that hidden gig work makes up what we think is more than half of the gig work in the UK. And this is kind of work that may be frequently done as side gigs, but when we think about creative professionals, that could be your full-time job, right? You're simply working as a creative professional through platforms. I would say here, some of the most visible jobs, not only are they more risky, they tend to be some of the lowest paid, while the least visible, like digital freelance work, could really be providing a kind of relatively good salary and a middle-class income to many people. And I bring that up because later, if we talk about policy or we talk about regulation, it's not really going to be a one-size-fits-all. There's lots of different types of platform work happening in Scotland.
And even with things like short-term lets, there's lots of different types of work that happen that people don't realize.
Mm, exactly. So, for example, in Airbnb, you almost have what I think of as sort of nested gig work and a kind of ecology of platforms that are enabling Airbnb to function in the city. So if you scratch the surface on an Airbnb listing, you're going to find that there are cleaners that come in, there are maintenance workers, there are key handover services, and all of that does not get necessarily accounted when we talk about what a gig economy is. So one platform can create multiple layers of different types of work, most of which I would just say are really just completely invisible unless you go looking for it.
Yeah, and what we often see is that workers end up using multiple platforms at the same time.
Absolutely. And I'm sure Sam can talk a bit more about this, but many people multi-app and multi-platform and now are looking at multi-platform livelihoods. And you might think about this as a kind of update on Marx's famous quip. You might be driving in the morning for one platform, delivering food for another platform in the afternoon, and doing cleaning jobs in the evening. You know, how people are combining those work over time now is something that I think we really do need to get to grips with. And when people's income is also spread out across those platforms, tracking that work through kind of traditional data sets and labor force statistics becomes even harder. But obviously, as I mentioned earlier, platforms have now been around for over 10 years. So people are obviously crafting livelihoods out of this kind of work in alongside traditional forms of labor. And again, that kind of makes it a kind of difficult space to think about not only getting a really good picture of what's going on day to day, but how do we think about fairly regulating this space?
Yeah, I think it'd be good to bring in Sam here. Sam, does this idea of juggling multiple platforms reflect your experience?
Yes, actually. I'm currently running around 4 apps at a time while I work as a delivery courier. I know plenty of other people who are also multi-apping, as we call it, because it's just not possible a lot of the time to make a decent income solely using one app. So you need to balance these different apps in order to make an income.
Yeah, and does that mean that you have to keep checking multiple apps at the same time just to see if any of them will have activity?
Yes, a lot of the time you're just standing about rejecting orders coming through because you're waiting for something decent to come through because a lot of the time they will provide you with offers which are so low that you would just be wasting your time.
Right.
So you often need to wait. And if you only were using one app, that waiting time would be expanded where you would be rejecting lots of terrible ones with long wait times in between the orders coming through.
Right, right. Do you feel the platform companies share enough information with riders?
No. Every app is different in the information they provide. Some are more transparent with the information they provide. The main app I use is Deliveroo, as it's one of the busiest in Scotland. But they hide quite a lot of information, like when you are first offered a job, they don't provide you with the mileage, the weight or how, or the size of the package which you need to pick up, what is in the package. This information is often given to you once you've accepted it or once you've shown up to the restaurant. But at that point, you might not want to take the item anymore because it might be too heavy or it might not be able to fit in the bag you're using.
Yeah, you already mentioned some of the effects it's having on your work. Is there any other examples of how this lack of information is affecting the way you plan your work every day?
For example, like I said, it's not super obvious how many miles you're going to have to cycle between the jobs. Along with that, you're not super clear on what items are going to be in it. So you might pick up a grocery shop, like something from a shop, like groceries. It could be one item. It could be 39 items. And that's a bit unfair because you don't know how. And it'll be the same pay. It can be as low as £2.90. Stuart, which is another courier app, has started to lower its fees to as low as £2.60 or £2.70, I should say, which just feels a bit ridiculous. And they're often large, large items. And my bag, for example, you can fit lots of stuff. It's very comfy. It's good for more weighty items. However, it's not the widest, so I can't pick up stuff like a pizza box. And I'm not sure on what items will be in the order till I show up to the restaurant. So there's been a lot of times I've shown up not knowing what's in the delivery because they've not supplied me with a size of a package. And then I've had to reject it because I can't deliver something like that to the customer in the same condition it's been provided to me with.
Right. Yeah. So you already mentioned that things like knowing the distance you have to travel and knowing what kind of items you have to deliver, having that information would be really helpful. Is there any other kind of information that would be helpful to you as a rider?
Yes, it'd be good to see a price breakdown when you are picking up multiple deliveries. So a lot of these apps are doing stacked orders now. So you will get multiple pickups and multiple drop-offs all at the same time. But they won't pay you for these jobs equally. So for example, if you start rejecting these jobs, you will start to notice pretty quickly that the first job, for example, they might be generous and give you something like £4. But the second pickup will go down to around £2. And I've seen jobs when it comes to the third one as low as £1. But that third one might be the furthest distance that you need to travel. And they don't show you the price of each drop-off. This is information which I think is quite crucial when you're trying to plan your work. Because if you know you're going to have to do a job which is 4 miles away for £1, you'll want to reject that. But there's no way of knowing how much that job is actually going to cost to do.
Can I also add one thing? When Sam rejects a job, if he doesn't work, he doesn't get paid. And that's ultimately the principle behind on-demand gig work. So while Sam is technically contracted as a self-employed contractor, he works for himself. He gets to decide when he wants to work, where he wants to work, who he wants to work for, as you're saying, multiple apps. He actually doesn't have any of the information available to him to make really good and informed choices, which would be the hallmark of kind of self-employment and entrepreneurship. You get to determine your wages. But really, he's not paid for waiting time. So if he's sitting around in Edinburgh trying to figure out which job is the best, that's downtime for you. That's money you're not making. So we've been trying to think about, you know, the kind of perverse incentives that encourage people to do this type of work. And maybe, Sam, you could talk a little bit more about how you do make decisions. Like, what is worth it here?
So at the end of the day, you never really know. Sometimes you will get up at a time or start working at a time that is busy normally. But it could be the odd day where it's just absolutely dead, which happens quite a lot. Sometimes you'll be comfortably be able to make £15 an hour. Other times you'll be on £3 an hour. And you don't know. You don't know if it's going to be a day like that or not.
How do you negotiate that? How do you make sense of that week by week?
I suppose sometimes if, unlike other jobs where you just have a set wage that you will receive, I just try and get a goal. So it's usually a daily goal or a weekly goal. Sometimes I'll make that, sometimes I won't. But this often means that if I have a good week, I can maybe take it easy, have like only work about 4 days. But then there's other days where I've had to work the whole week, all 7 days, in order to make that income. And it just makes it difficult to have that work-life balance. And it results in becoming quite burnt out quite often, unless you're pretty good at this sort of planning or organizing your week in a way which doesn't completely tire you out.
So Sam, how did you end up doing this job?
So I started doing this job to make extra money while I was studying. After finishing at university, I've decided to carry on this full time. The reason I continue to work this type of job is for the flexibility, or is times I want to be able to go away for longer periods of time as my partner lives in another city. So I use this job to be flexible in that way. That allows me to work for longer periods of time when I've got time in Edinburgh, but also work shorter amount of time when I need to be in another city, for example. So I think this job works really well if you have that type of lifestyle where you're not necessarily in the same place. It also allows you to work in other places as well. Deliveroo, you're able to just change your city. So you could be working in Edinburgh one day, working in Glasgow another. You could go down to England, work in Leeds, work in Manchester. That flexibility is really good. But you've got to admit sometimes that the pay is difficult.
Yeah, I think this is definitely something we've heard from a lot of workers, and we've heard from workers in previous episodes as well. There's certainly advantages that people appreciate about some of the flexibility that this job provides. For example, for delivery riders, a lot of people just they enjoy the actual activity of cycling around the city, but many disadvantages that you've explained are really making things difficult for people, aren't they?
I mean, I think that's a really clear point, Boyan. When I was interviewing riders a few years ago, the freedom to set your own hours, spend time on a bike, highly preferable to working in a pub or working in retail where there are 0 hours contracts. And the flexibility, again, I mean, I think if we look back over the history of work and labor, the demand for fair work-life balance, the demand for flexible working hours, these come from things like, you know, feminist demands for work, for fair work. But platforms have kind of taken that, you know, be your own boss motto. And what I think they're doing is using that flexibility to kind of paste over a lot of exploitation. And one of the things that we haven't really talked about is getting kind of caught in platform work. You know, Sam, do you feel like you know what will come next after this, or...
I'm not 100% sure where I will work in the future. I don't see this type of delivery work sustainable to do for years and years and years. People do, but I think for myself, I just find the job extremely tiring. And while it works right now, I think as my situation changes and as I get older, I won't necessarily want to continue doing this. I currently have friends who are trying to work out different ways of making income. This might be starting their own career businesses, which has been happening with a few of my mates who have started a cargo company. I have another friend who's going more into window cleaning, which is another type of gig work, but it's a gig work where you can choose your own pay. It might still be low compared to some things, but you have the choice to make your own decisions on how you work. The problem with this job is, although, as you said, self-employed, unlike other self-employed work, you have no choice in what you're actually getting paid. You have to just take what you're offered.
And speaking of some of the disadvantages in this job, this series has focused on migrant workers because they are majority in many of the workplaces, such as delivery workers in Edinburgh. So Karen, is this gap in data particularly acute for this group of workers?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, just to step back, a few years ago, platforms were able to sell to people an idea of flexibility and good wages. And what we've seen over the last maybe 5-6 years is kind of a race to the bottom. So there is a kind of downward pressure on wages. And as you're saying, you know, you'll pick up one thing for a good price and then the next one is pretty low. And over time, you start to notice, I'm not even making minimum wage doing this. But actually, what platforms then do is they become an infrastructure for some of the most vulnerable people, vulnerable workers, to start to pick up work. And migrant workers are disproportionately represented in the most physically demanding and precarious work, which is food delivery, cleaning, and care. And truthfully, I think they are really some of the most invisible in the data. And there are really good reasons for that. If you think about the current, you know, climate in the UK around immigration and migration. But for example, language barriers make it harder for people to participate in surveys. Immigration status becomes a real fear, and I think we can't really downplay that, you know, of identifying yourself as a worker or a precarious worker. Some people are just simply worried that being counted also means being identified and potentially removed from the country. So there's also people who are on visas that really, you know, don't permit them to do the kind of work they're doing. And I think we are watching a kind of shadow economy build up in the platforms. But again, we haven't seen a very reasonable response from regulators. What we have seen is kind of rocking up fears about immigration and asylum seekers doing illegal work. But the truth is, as Sam said, many people come here to study as students and pick up this work because it fits around being a student. So once that student visa runs out, many people want to stay rather than punishing them. We should be looking for avenues into fair, sustainable work. And it does all of this conversation about who's doing this work taps into what we were just talking about. What kind of mobility does platform labor create for workers? Where do you go next from this? What skills are you building up? What's transferable? And where do you think this is going to lead you down the road?
Yeah, and I think that brings us back to the fifth policy in the gig workers platform, which is about getting a better picture of gig work in Scotland, because without that clear picture, we don't know who is doing it, where, and under what conditions. I mean, we do know a lot, but without bridging this gap in the data, without the government taking a more focused approach to it, it becomes very difficult to design good policy, especially with how many different types of work and different types of platforms are part of the gig economy.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think while the data issue is something that maybe researchers like myself can take on, as I said earlier, data is there. It's fragmented. It's waiting for us to kind of create data portals and to create more tangible evidence that regulators can use. Getting the bigger picture, as you're talking about, though, isn't just a data issue. more data doesn't necessarily solve the problem. I think what we need is to recognize the real full complexity of gig work, particularly in Scotland, whereas, as I said, there's kind of regional differences in different types of platforms shaping local economies, and getting to grips with the realities of what the work looks like in everyday workers' lives like Sam. So this means understanding that there is a difference between this kind of visible and hidden gig economy. Those may look like very different experiences, as well as those urban and rural differences that are playing out here. One policy for all platforms may have very different and very dire consequences for local economies. And I think, of course, we need to hear from workers like Sam and draw, I would say, workers' voices into these very conversations about how we move forward. Workers are the expert of their own working process. You guys know these platforms in and out better than any researcher ever will. You're also experts of how these platforms are shaping and affecting the city. You're kind of the eyes on the road, as it is. So I think, you know, drawing that expertise of workers, and especially from the most vulnerable workers, into conversations in Scotland, where we are starting to talk about fair work and what that kind of policy will really look like at a national scale. Without drawing those workers' voices in, any policy is going to miss the mark.
Sam, how, as a gig worker yourself, how do you think more workers could be brought into these conversations?
So I think doing sort of the meetings like we've done with the Workers Observatory have given good opportunities for me and other riders to be able to talk about our experiences working as couriers and working in the streets. Because although we're working in very similar jobs, we do have very different experiences. People are going to have different experiences to me or the way that my day works, even dependent on maybe some of the apps that people are running and the slight differences between them. I think continuing to push with sort of making this more public, like with today's podcast or videos, or even just making some of these meetings more public and letting other people from outside our community in to listen, could shine some light into what it's really like to be a worker in the city doing gig work.
Yeah, that's excellent. And it's good to hear that these kinds of meetings are hopefully helping to raise awareness about these issues. Karen, from a research perspective, what kind of models work well to do this, to raise awareness and to sort of elevate workers' voices?
Yeah, that's a great question. I think, well, as Sam mentioned, I think the Workers' Observatory is based on a premise of worker inquiry. It is a Marxist tradition of enabling workers to ask and answer questions about their working conditions. So I think it's a relatively elegant and simple idea. Workers come together, given a common concern. How much have I made this week? What can I predict my wages? We bring workers together not just as workers, but as co-researchers. They set a research question, and then we think what methods and what tools are at our disposal to answer those questions. And that can range from, you know, social science, things like surveys and interviews and focus group, whatever would be right to reach your research question. It also may include gaining new data skills, right, to get workers to think, okay, I actually want to make a point that something's happening in this job, that it's dangerous, that I haven't earned enough money. And we actually help those workers generate evidence. So building up a heat map of where accidents are happening in the city, or developing evidence to show, look, my wages have fallen way below minimum wage, and be able to take that collectively to things like the city council. So that's one model. I mean, that's participatory co-research with workers. And I'm sure that there are other models that really do work well to think about how you combine data, how you think about policy analysis, and how you bring worker voices into one place. But I have a sense that the kind of observatory model works really well because basically from the ground up, it's worker-led. And it's not a kind of, you know, we don't know where this is going. Essentially, we're trying to get you guys good answers to questions that you have, also while trying to shine some light on this through new types of media. So if that's building up podcasts or it's building up blogs, I think implicit in what we're doing here is also a project around upskilling and having this implicitly a conversation about mobility. So hopefully some of the things that we are doing in the observatory become transferable, like learning to do a podcast or learning to write a blog or learning to write a kind of policy pressy for a regulator to look at. But I'd be also open to other kinds of models if people had something to, you know, if we can find others. I'm really open to learning how to do this well.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, speaking of policy, we've got the election coming up in a few days. So Sam, last word to you. What would you want a politician listening to this to take away?
I think it would just be good for them to understand what this type of work is. I don't think it's clear to the general public how these platforms work. I think people just expect their food to come to them and people to just be paid. And maybe that's how it should be, but I'm just doing this job. I don't have all the answers of how these companies should be running things. I can give some advice. But I think if there's anything I think there should be a bit more pressure put towards these companies in order to make sure that they are paying their workers well. They might not say fit their employers, but they choose the wage. So I think the government could have some say in how these companies are run.
Yeah, for sure. Thank you both very much for joining us today. This was a great conversation. And this was the last episode of our podcast, Gig Workers Guide to the Scottish Election. To read the platform of five policies launched by Deliver Workers in Edinburgh, go to our website at workersobservatory.org. Keep an eye out for more exciting projects from the Workers Observatory coming soon. Thanks for listening.